A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hello, Herman and Quirin. I am enjoying listening very much to the episode about puppetry and the Ballard Institute and stores. And I actually visited the Ballard Institute, believe it or not. In fact, there's a video on YouTube of me touring the Ballard Museum. And they did actually mention off camera that Herman used to move boxes, as you said. In fact, I think Herman's underselling his contribution. I believe he even led some tours in his youth. But stores is, you know, a powerhouse of so much, but certainly I think it possibly lays claim to being the ideological epicenter of the modern puppetry world, which is not what people think when they see a sleepy village in stores. But that's stores in a nutshell. It's a place that is just deep. The more you dig into stores, the more you uncover the various layers of this fascinating place. And I hope, drawing upon Herman's experience growing up there in Horsebourne Hill, as you mentioned, we can really unpeel many more layers of not just stores, but also Mansfield history. So I'd love to talk, Herman and Quirin. I do like to create these connections to make our disparate topics seem a bit more related. We talked about puppetry, and you mentioned that one of the moments of evolution in the storied history of puppetry, which is really quite interesting, its recognition as a serious art form, was a decision by to have the puppeteer visible and not hidden. And it made me think about background removal, which I had meant to send a prompt in about a few days ago, and kind of the modern, I do a little bit of my own puppeteering with Herman and Quirin. In fact, the two of you, your physical likeness, I've experimented with. I got some fishing wire to make 3D models of you and to create I actually created some 3D characters of Herman and Quirin, with the idea of using those models as a basis for, firstly, image generation with Laura's, and then ultimately, I mean, I guess doing an animated series featuring the characters of Herman and Quirin is an aspiration. And video Laura's, for character consistency, are still at a fairly early stage. But a big part of training up characters, for those who have tried to do this, is if we take stuffed animals or plushies, and it's actually something that there's a paucity of training data for, I would say, and is doing background removal. So let's say I take some images of Quirin shot in various locations. I might want to use a grey background for some training data. I might want to use the real background for others, and then for another set, I might want to do true transparency background removal on the alpha layer, because there's nothing in the background. It's a bit of an open question among people who train Laura's whether you get the best results with a grey background or going totally transparent. But this diversion is to talk about the background removal tools with AI. And I mentioned puppetry because if you wanted to do real work of this nature, up till very recently, you were looking at green screens. And even for in the world of puppetry, using green screen gloves, for example, to hide the puppeteer's hands. And the thing about green screens is they're kind of cumbersome, especially if you're doing this stuff at home. And now we're seeing a lot of AI tools that offer green screen free background removal. We have to mention one really famous package, which is RemBG. I just realized before I sent this in that's clearly short for remove background. But RemBG is one of the, I guess, foundational packages in background removal. And like everything in AI, doing stuff at one image is one layer of difficulty, and doing it as video is another layer, video being just a series of images. So I've tried out some of the background removal models that work at the video layer, and some of them have tentatively promising results. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, Herman and Corinne, I thought I'd ask you for, let's start with the foundations of background removal for those who have used it. And I'm talking about not just the, you know, the kind of old background removal, like you'd clip around an object, the the modern form that is tools like when you see some of these SaaS implementations, they make it look so easy. You grab a figure and you say remove background and suddenly you've got transparency on the background. But what's actually happening under the hood is clipping, object detection, being able to separate a person or a foreground in some cases from the background. There's a lot of complication. So I'd love to understand a little bit more about how these tools actually work and how they're enabling us to, for those of us who inspired by puppeteering are looking to use AI characters in different contexts, whether inspired by plushies, real people, real objects, anything. Background removal plays actually a really important part in the creative process.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a bit of a winding path. He's been experimenting with making plushy versions of me and Herman, training lores on them, and he's run into the whole question of background removal. What's actually happening when you click remove background and suddenly get transparent pixels? And he's drawing this connection to puppetry. The moment puppeteers stopped hiding behind curtains and became visible, which changed the art form. I want to dig into both threads, but let's start with the tech. What's actually under the hood?
Before we dive in, quick note, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today. Alright, so background removal. The thing most people don't realize is that what looks like a single click is actually several different AI systems working in sequence. The foundational architecture behind a lot of modern background removal is something called U2Net, or U2Net, which came out of the University of Alberta in 2020. It's a salient object detection model.
Salient object detection, meaning it figures out what the main thing in the image is.
And the way it does that is clever. Most neural networks for image tasks process information at one scale. They look at the whole image, or they look at patches. U2Net has this nested architecture where it's processing the image at multiple scales simultaneously. It's got a 6-stage encoder and a 5-stage decoder, and at each stage it's fusing information from different resolutions. So it can see both the fine details, individual hairs, the edge of a sleeve, and the overall shape of the object.
It's like having 6 different people looking at the same image, each from a different distance, and then pooling what they see.
That's actually a decent way to think about it, and the U shape comes from the fact that the architecture goes down in resolution and then back up. It looks like a U when you draw it out. The key innovation was what they called residual U blocks. Each block captures context at multiple scales internally, and then the blocks are stacked. It's a lot of compute, but it produces really clean masks.
A mask is just a black and white image that says, these pixels stay, these go.
The model outputs a probability map. For every pixel, it predicts how likely it is to be foreground. You threshold that, and you've got your mask. But here's where it gets interesting for Daniel's question about green screens. The old way of doing this, and I mean the pre-deep learning way, was either chroma keying, which is the green screen approach, or it was graph cut algorithms where you'd manually scribble on foreground and background, and the algorithm would propagate your labels.
Chroma keying works because you've got a known uniform color that you can mathematically subtract. If a pixel is within a certain range of green, it goes.
That's the idea, but the reality was always messier. Green spill, where green light bounces off the screen onto the subject, was a constant problem. Fine hair, translucent materials, motion blur at the edges. All of that made clean keys really difficult, and you needed an evenly lit screen, no wrinkles, the right distance between subject and background. It was a whole discipline.
What Daniel's actually asking about is the jump from chroma keying to semantic understanding. The model isn't looking for a specific color, it's looking for objects.
That's the fundamental shift. U2Net and similar models don't care what color your background is. They've learned what objects look like, what a person looks like, what a plushie looks like, and they separate foreground from background based on that semantic understanding. The training data is thousands and thousands of images where humans have manually labeled every pixel as foreground or background. The model learns the visual patterns that distinguish subject from surround.
When Daniel's photographing plushy versions of us, the model is recognizing this is a stuffed animal, this is an object with volume and edges, and separating it from whatever's behind it.
That's actually a harder problem than it sounds for plushies specifically, because plush toys often have fuzzy edges, they've got texture that can blend with certain backgrounds, and they're not as common in training datasets as humans. There's a reason Daniel mentioned a paucity of training data for stuffed animals. Most of these models are trained heavily on portraits, product photography, that kind of thing. A sloth plushie on a messy desk is a different challenge than a person on a plain background.
That's probably why he's asking about gray backgrounds versus true transparency. He's trying to figure out what gives the lore the cleanest signal during training.
That's an empirical question that people in the lore community argue about. The theory behind using a gray background is that it provides a neutral, consistent context that the model can learn to ignore. If every training image has a different background, a park, a living room, a kitchen, the model might accidentally learn that the background is part of the concept. You tell it, learn Corn the Sloth, and it learns Corn the Sloth plus a bunch of random furniture.
Whereas, if you strip the background entirely with an alpha channel, you're giving the model nothing but the subject.
But in practice, alpha transparency introduces edge artifacts. The boundary between the subject and the transparent area can look unnatural, and the model might learn those artifacts as part of the subject. Some people swear by gray backgrounds because they provide a soft, consistent edge. Others insist that transparency is the only way to prevent background contamination. There's no settled answer yet.
Which I suspect is exactly why Daniel's experimenting with both. Now, you mentioned U2Net, but that's not the only architecture out there. What about the video side? He mentioned trying video background removal.
Video is a whole different beast. If you run a single image model on each frame independently, you get temporal inconsistency. The mask flickers from frame to frame because the model makes slightly different decisions on each one. It's the same problem as frame-by-frame rotoscoping versus modern video inpainting. You need temporal coherence.
The solution is to include information from previous frames in the prediction for the current frame.
There are models like RVM, Robust Video Matting, that use recurrent neural networks to carry information forward. The model sees the current frame plus a hidden state from previous frames, so it can maintain a consistent understanding of what's foreground and what's background even as things move. Google's got a model called MediaPipe that does this for video calls. Meta released one called SAM, the Segment Anything Model, which handles both images and can be extended to video.
SAM was a big deal when it dropped. The anything part is doing a lot of work there.
SAM was genuinely impressive because it's promptable. You can give it points, boxes, or masks as input, and it'll segment whatever you're pointing at. And it was trained on a dataset of over 1 billion masks, 11 million images, each with multiple annotations. The scale of that dataset is what makes it so generalizable. It handles objects it's never seen before because it's seen so many different kinds of objects during training.
Daniel's plushie problem would be less of a problem for Sam, because it's seen enough variety to handle fuzzy stuffed animals.
But Sam is heavy, it's a big model. The REMG tool Daniel mentioned, that's more of a package solution. REMG, which as Daniel noted, is clearly short for Remove Background. I love when naming is that literal. REMG is essentially a wrapper around U2Net and similar models. It provides a simple API or command line interface. You throw an image at it, you get a transparent PNG back. It's become the go-to for people doing LoRa training precisely because it's simple and reliable.
It handles the alpha channel properly, which is not trivial. A lot of cheaper implementations just composite onto white and call it a day.
Right, and if you're training a LoRa, you need real transparency, not just a white background that looks transparent. The alpha channel actually matters for the training pipeline. REMG and tools like it. There's also remove.bg, which is a commercial API that uses a proprietary model. They all output proper RGBA images with the alpha channel intact.
Let's connect this back to puppetry, because Daniel's prompt had this interesting thread about visibility. He mentioned that a key moment in puppetry's evolution as a serious art form was the decision to make the puppeteer visible rather than hidden.
This is something I actually know about from my time in stores. The Ballard Institute and Museum of Puppetry, which is part of UConn, was founded by Frank Ballard, who was the first person to establish a puppetry degree program at an American university. That was in the 1960s. This is genuinely an open question in the lore training community, and I've seen the debates. The argument for grade backgrounds is that they provide a neutral, consistent context.
He's the one who pushed for visible puppeteers?
Not exclusively. The visible puppeteer tradition has roots in Japanese bunraku, where the puppeteers are on stage in black robes and in various experimental theater movements. But Ballard absolutely championed it in the American context. And that's the argument for true transparency, an alpha channel with nothing behind the subject. The idea is that the model learns the subject in isolation, and during inference, whatever background you prompt for fills in naturally. But the problem is that most base models aren't trained on images with alpha channels. They're trained on RGB images with backgrounds. So feeding them RGBA data with transparency can produce unexpected behavior.
It's a Brechtian move. Don't pretend. Show the strings, show the hands, and let the audience appreciate the skill.
And that shift from hiding the mechanism to celebrating it is what elevated puppetry in the eyes of theater critics and arts institutions. There's a third option that some practitioners advocate, which is keeping diverse real backgrounds.
Which is a fascinating parallel to what Daniel's doing with AI characters. He's not trying to convince anyone that his plushy Lauras are real. He's making the process visible. The strings are the training data, the background removal, the model architecture.
There's something honest about that approach. That's a really good way to frame it. Subject fidelity versus compositing flexibility. And I don't think there's a settled answer.
I think that's why Daniel framed the prompt this way. He's not just asking for a technical explainer on background removal. He's saying, here's the craft, here are the decisions. The technology is the puppet, and I'm the puppeteer trying to figure out how visible I should be.
Which brings us back to the green screen point. In traditional puppetry for film, you'd use green screen gloves to hide the puppeteer's hands. That's the equivalent of chroma keying. You remove the mechanism by targeting a specific color. The AI approach is different. The AI doesn't need a specific color. It understands what hands look like, what puppets look like, and it can separate them semantically.
Here's the thing. Sometimes you want the hands visible. Bunraku puppeteers wear black, but their hands are right there, manipulating the puppet's expressions. The audience sees the craft. So the question isn't just, how do we remove the background? It's, what do we want the audience to see?
That's a creative decision, not a technical one. The tools give you options. You can strip everything but the subject. You can keep a natural background. You can use a gray background for training and then composite onto anything you want later. The technology doesn't dictate the aesthetic. It enables choices.
It says, this separation happened and here's the evidence.
I think that's a lovely parallel, actually. And it gets at something real about how these tools are changing creative workflows. When you use RIMBG or similar tools, you're not just removing a background, you're making a decision about what constitutes the subject. The model has to make a semantic judgment. Where does the sloth end and the world begin?
Which loops back to the background removal question. If you're photographing a physical plushie against different backgrounds, you need clean extractions to build a consistent dataset. Especially with fur. I mean, I have fur. Plushy Me presumably has simulated fur. Where exactly does the boundary lie when you've got individual fibers?
That's the alpha map problem at its most acute. With fur or hair, there is no clean boundary. Each pixel at the edge is a mixture of foreground and background color. The alpha value at that pixel represents the proportion, 0.7 foreground, 0.3 background, something like that. Getting those values right requires the model to understand the structure of the edge. Is this a hard edge like a table?
The quality of your background removal directly determines the quality of your character model.
And it's not just about removing the background, it's about how you remove it. A hard edge looks unnatural. A feathered edge can look blurry. The best tools do what's called alpha matting, which estimates partial transparency at the boundary. A single pixel at the edge of a plushie might be 60% foreground and 40% background. That's what gives you realistic compositing later.
Alpha matting is the hard problem. Binary segmentation, foreground or background, is relatively straightforward. But real edges have transparency. Hair, fur, fuzz on a plushie. Those all have pixels that are a mix.
On the DUTS dataset, which is a standard benchmark, it hits an F measure of around 0.93, which is remarkably high. The nested U structure allows it to capture features at multiple scales simultaneously. The overall shape of the subject, the mid-level texture patterns, and the fine edge details, all in one forward pass.
One forward pass, meaning it processes the image once, end-to-end, rather than iterating.
Right, and that's important for video applications. If you're doing background removal of video, which Daniel mentioned he's experimenting with, you need speed. Processing 30 frames per second with a slow model isn't practical. U2net is relatively efficient because it does everything in one shot. No iterative refinement, no user interaction. Image in, alpha mat out.
Let's talk about video then, because Daniel mentioned some tentatively promising results with video background removal models. What changes when you go from still images to video?
Everything gets harder, fundamentally. In a still image, the model only has spatial information to work with, the arrangement of pixels in a two-dimensional grid. In video, you have temporal information too, how pixels change from frame to frame. And that temporal dimension introduces two big challenges. One is temporal consistency. If the alpha mat flickers from frame to frame, if the boundary wobbles even slightly, it's extremely noticeable.
Optical flow being the vector field that describes how each pixel moves between frames.
If you know that pixel A moved from position X to position Y, you can propagate the mask accordingly. But optical flow itself is an estimation problem. It's not perfect, especially with fast motion or occlusions. The second challenge is motion blur. When a subject moves quickly, individual frames contain smeared pixels that are a blend of foreground and background over time. The model has to handle those frames without creating ghosting artifacts.
Which is why the results are tentatively promising, as Daniel put it.
Others use three-dimensional convolutions that process multiple frames together as a volume, learning spatio-temporal features directly. But if you've got a moving camera, complex motion, or multiple subjects, it gets messy fast.
Daniel is trying to do character animation, which means the characters will be moving, the backgrounds will be changing, and he needs consistent masks across potentially hundreds of frames.
But plushy fabric changes appearance as it deforms. The nap of the fabric catches light differently at different angles, so the optical flow estimates might be noisy, which cascades into poor temporal consistency in the alpha mat. Or they use a tool like Rotobrush in After Effects, which propagates a mask across frames using optical flow and some machine learning. It's semi-automated. You make corrections on problematic frames, and the tool adjusts the interpolation.
We're not at the point where you can just hit remove background on a video and get production quality results.
To where it is now, with one-click tools running in real time on consumer hardware, the progress is remarkable, and the underlying architectures keep improving.
Which, again, is puppetry. The puppeteer doesn't just show up and wave the puppet around. There's hours of construction, rigging, rehearsal. The visible performance is the tip of the iceberg.
I think that's the deeper point Daniel's getting at. The AI tools are impressive. You can remove backgrounds with a click, generate characters from text prompts, but the craft is still there. It means the network is trained with additional loss functions at intermediate layers, not just at the final output.
There's a quote I like. I think it was from a puppeteer at the Ballard Institute, actually. The puppet is not an object that moves. It's an object that is moved. The distinction matters. The AI model isn't making creative decisions. It's being moved.
The visible puppeteer tradition says, don't hide that, show the process, let the audience see the craft. Daniel's approach, photographing physical plushies, training Loras, experimenting with backgrounds, that's all process. Yes, it pushes more gradient signal to the early layers that are responsible for fine spatial detail. In a deep network, the early layers have the highest spatial resolution but the weakest semantic signal.
Let me pull on another thread Daniel mentioned. He talked about the Ballard Institute and Storrs being the ideological epicenter of modern puppetry. You grew up in Storrs. You've got skin in this game.
I do, and I'll defend Storrs to the death. It's easy to dismiss it as a sleepy Connecticut village. Yukon's there, some farms, not much else. But Frank Ballard chose Storrs for a reason. The result is sharper boundaries with fewer of those alpha mat ambiguities we discussed.
You worked there moving boxes, as Daniel pointed out.
I did, and I'll say this. Daniel's right that I undersold my contribution. I didn't just move boxes. I led tours. I helped catalog the collection. I spent hours in the archives reading Ballard's production notes. The man was meticulous. He documented everything. Puppet construction, performance techniques, audience reactions. He treated puppetry as a scholarly discipline, and that's what made Storrs the center of gravity.
When Daniel talks about unpeeling the layers of Storrs in Mansfield history, he's tapping into something real. There's depth there.
Use RIMGI or a similar tool to generate clean alpha matis, export with true transparency for some portion of your training data, but also keep a subset with varied real backgrounds. The key is the captioning. For the transparent background images, your captions should explicitly note that the background is transparent or removed. For the real background images, describe the setting. That way, the model learns the distinction between the subject and its context, rather than baking the context into the subject representation.
The gray background option?
I'd use gray sparingly, if at all. Gray is a specific color. If your model sees too many images with a neutral gray background, it might learn that gray is the default context for the character. Then when you prompt for corn in a jungle, the model might struggle because it's trying to reconcile corn plus gray void with corn plus jungle. The gray bleeds into the learned representation.
That makes sense. The transparency approach, even if it's a bit unnatural for the base model, at least doesn't introduce a spurious color association.
And some practitioners have reported good results by training on RGBA images directly, converting the alpha channel to a fourth input channel alongside RGBB. It requires modifying the model's input layer, which is more technically involved, but it lets the model learn to handle transparency natively.
Let's talk about one more technical angle, because I think it's important for understanding how these tools actually work in practice. You mentioned that U2Net and similar models are trained on human annotated data. I want to circle back to something Daniel said in his prompt that I think is worth unpacking.
That's the generalization problem. A model trained primarily on humans and common objects might struggle with unusual subjects, like, say, a sloth plushie photographed from an odd angle under mixed lighting. The Ballard Institute and Museum of Puppetry is at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. It's one of the largest collections of puppets in the United States, over 2,500 puppets from around the world.
That's where the anything and segment anything model really matters. The billion mask dataset means it's seen enough variety to handle edge cases.
Frank Ballard, who the institute is named after, founded the program in the 1960s and was a major figure in establishing puppetry as a serious academic and artistic discipline. A green pixel next to a slightly different green pixel. Is that the edge of the plushie, or is it the rug?
That's exactly the kind of situation where the old chroma key approach had an advantage. If you know the background is a specific green, there's no ambiguity. You just subtract that color. The AI approach is more flexible, but it introduces uncertainty.
Which is why some people in the LoRa community still use green screens for their training data. It's a hybrid approach. Use a green screen to get a clean key, then use AI to clean up the edges and handle any spill. Best of both worlds.
Daniel's question about gray backgrounds versus transparency. There's actually a third option, which is to use a controlled physical background and do a traditional key, then refine with AI.
It hosts performances, it runs educational programs, it's a research center. People come from all over the world to study there. And it's in Storrs, Connecticut, population something like 15,000. It's more work, but you get cleaner training data.
The puppeteer's approach. Control what you can control, and use the tools to handle the rest.
The evolution from hidden puppeteer to visible puppeteer was a philosophical shift. It changed what puppetry meant as an art form. Background removal in AI is grappling with the same fundamental question. What's foreground? What's background? What's the subject, and what's context? And should the mechanism of that distinction be visible or hidden?
The visible mechanism. The alpha mat. The segmentation boundary. The model's judgment about where the subject ends. That's a creative choice, not just a technical one. If you're using AI background removal in an artistic workflow, you're implicitly adopting a philosophy about what's foreground and what's context. The model's training data embodies a set of aesthetic judgments about what matters in an image.
Those judgments aren't neutral. A model trained primarily on portrait photography will have different ideas about what constitutes a subject than a model trained on product photography or wildlife photography. The magic of one-click background removal is that it hides those judgments behind a simple interface, but they're still there, shaping the output.
Which is why Daniel's experimentation, trying different approaches, gray versus transparent, real backgrounds versus removed, is actually the right way to engage with these tools. You don't just accept the default, you probe the edges.
Even when you can't see them.
All right, before we wrap, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The visible puppeteer tradition makes that understanding explicit. Good creative work with AI tools requires the same kind of mechanical sympathy, knowing what's happening under the hood so you can work with it rather than against it.
In 1847, a British naval surgeon stationed in Belize nearly discovered the medical value of horseshoe crab blood when he noticed that wounded crabs in his collection produced a strange blue clotting agent, but he dismissed it as a curious marine excretion and threw the specimens overboard during a storm.
We were one storm away from a century-early medical breakthrough.
Under the hood, it's running U2NET or ISNET, depending on which model you specify. The default model handles human portraits well.
Einkorn, if you're experimenting with character lures or background removal, we'd love to hear about your workflow. What's working, what's not. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com. If Remji doesn't cut it, if the segmentation boundaries aren't clean enough for plushy fur,
then you step up to more sophisticated tools. There's a whole ecosystem. Adobe's Sensei-based background removal in Photoshop is remarkably good, though it's proprietary. Remove.bg is a popular web service.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.